Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 11, HDMI Demystified. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Greetings to one and all Home Theater Geeks. I'm Scott Wilkinson with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is Jeff Park, HDMI evangelist for HDMI Licensing, the company that develops and maintains the HDMI specification. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be awarded as a geek, actually. So I'm a self-acclaimed geek also, so I always enjoy watching your show, and it's an honor to be on here.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to make sure to get an HDMI geek on here because there's a lot of confusion around HDMI that I'm really looking forward to talking with you about.
Yes, we try hard. Yes, thank you.
Very good. First of all, though, I have to say, HDMI evangelist?
Yeah.
Sounds kind of more like a marketing position, but you're a fairly technically oriented guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, the product itself requires me to be a technical person. It's not, you know, it's not just selling some sort of a consumer product or a product that someone like my mom could just understand right away. Sell specification, we sell technology. So it requires that the technology itself to be, you know, evangelized to worldwide audience, not just to a simple consumer, but all the way down to the actual people who develop and make the actual products.
Right. And so how do you make your money? I mean, I guess licensing, people who want to use HDMI have to pay you some licensing fee or something like that?
Yeah, so HDMI was developed by 7 companies. A little background, 7 companies that were developed the technology, they put in technology into the specification. So they worked many years to create these technologies to enable HDMI what it is today. So in return for this technology, companies pay a small fee, anywhere either $5,000 or $10,000 annually, and that the amount depends on your volume. So if you're a small company, you can pay $5,000. If your volumes are higher, then you'll pay $10,000, plus a nominal royalty per unit, not per port, but per unit, anywhere from 4 cents up to 15 cents, but typically most people pay 4 cents. Royalties per product on HDMI devices.
Okay, so if a TV, say, has 4 or 5 ports, they're still only going to pay that 4 cents or whatever per unit.
Correct. It's per unit. They can have 50 ports, they'll still only pay a single royalty fee.
Right. So this is how HDMI licensing stays afloat, makes its money.
Correct. And that's how the founding companies who, you know, drove a lot of technology into the specification gets their return. In terms of the investment they have made so far into this technology.
Mm-hmm. But do even those companies have to pay licensing fees to?
No, they're the founding companies. It's their technology. So basically,
so it's theirs.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, they're in the party, right? So they're part of the party, so they get some benefits, basically.
Right. Who are those 7 founding companies?
So 7 founding companies are Sony, Panasonic, Hitachi, Toshiba, Philips, Thomson, who's now Technicolor, and Silicon Image.
Right. And Thomson/Technicolor, is that still related to RCA or not any longer?
I can't remember. I'm not sure. I don't think they are. They might have spun that off a while back.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Silicon Image is the only company among them that does not make a product for the end user, right?
Correct. They're a semiconductor company.
And they provide the HDMI transceiver chips and all the underlying hardware that these other companies use and put in their products to implement HDMI.
Correct, but not necessarily the only person or only company within the 7 founding companies that make chips. So Sony, for example, have their chip division. Hitachi has their chip division. Toshiba, Panasonic, they all have their separate chip divisions.
True enough.
That make chips in addition to Silicon Image. So.
Right. Right. Okay. So people can buy their chips from any one of these companies and implement
Correct.
HDMI.
Correct. And there's many other players available. So the spec is available to anybody who wants a license. So you can have, you know, ADI, for example, or Broadcom or Marvell, Intel, any of these chip makers that want to make HDMI chips can fully take advantage of the specification and technology, just like Silicon Image or Panasonic or any of the founders can.
I wanted to ask you about version numbers. You know, every time we talk about HDMI, we talk about 1.3, 1.4, all the way back to 1.0.
Yeah.
And that there's an awful lot of confusion about that. Can you help me understand that a little better?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think we did a great job of confusing everybody. So, you know, that's a start. Let us keep our job, right, basically. But,
yes,
but basically,
exactly.
You know, the specification, as you know, is that just that, a specification, technology, piece of paper on how to basically create this HDMI connection on their devices. And the intention for the originally, the intent was that version number was intended for the manufacturers only. So if you're a Sony, Samsung, Intel, whoever's making something for HDMI ecosystem, they care to see the version number because they need to understand the technical differences between the two. Mm-hmm. But when it came down to actual implementations, TVs, DVD players, Blu-ray, version numbers really then translate. Reason being is the version number that people are used to does not equate the same properties as a version number you would see on a software or on a like a USB or a PC-centric type of version number. So, for example, So if you had, for example, Windows, say, 1, for example, you know you're limited to a certain amount of features. If you moved up to Windows 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, every iteration of feature brought in new, better capabilities, new feature, and so on and so forth. And you knew if you got that version, you're going to get this group of features, which it's guaranteed to be available in that particular version. However, with the specification, that's different because the specification has to maintain backward compatibility. All the new features are optional. So what that means is I can have a device that was released 1.3, three different devices that were released and claimed to be built on using the 1.3 specification. Well, the version number really doesn't mean anything because all the new features are optional. So one device can have, say, you know, deep color, 1080p, XV color, all the advanced features. You know, if it's 1.4, then all the 3D features, for example. Well, that's not guaranteed for every single device because the specification version number only refers to what's available, not what's actually implemented into the device. So one of the things we're trying to do is eliminate the version numbers because, for example, if you buy a TV today that says 1.4, what does that mean? It doesn't really mean anything to the end user other than the fact that they use the 1.4 specification to build that device. It doesn't guarantee you 3D. It doesn't guarantee you 1080p. It doesn't guarantee you Ethernet because all those features are optional. That's why the version numbers were really designed for manufacturers for reference purposes, not for them to market and take advantage and kind of confuse the market. Because people understand version number much quickly than, say, a feature name. For example, if I call it 3D TV, for example, it takes a lot longer to explain why that's better than to say, this TV is 1.4, this TV is 1.3, therefore the higher number is better. So many manufacturers took the shortcut of just using version numbers to kind of, you know, make it easy to understand. But at the same time,
it really made it harder to understand.
Exactly, right? Because the old paradigm of version numbers that people are used to doesn't apply to HDMI or any specifications for that matter, because most specifications, you can think of it as a menu of features, a menu of features that's available in that particular version, but doesn't necessarily mean every device that was built using that spec will have all those features. Because the issue becomes is, okay, we as a specification say 1.3 devices must have all features, make it easy for consumers to understand. What that happens is then you will never have a $99 Blu-ray player in Walmart because if it has HDMI, then it's going to have 20,000 features and it's going to cost $10,000 because it has to incorporate every single one because we require that.
Right.
And that's the other extreme. And basically what we had to do is walk that fine line of allowing manufacturers to differentiate from a $99 Blu-ray player to a $10,000 Blu-ray player But at the same time, ensure basic interoperability so you have devices that can actually work between each other. So that's
really the goal of HDMI in general, and HDMI licensing in particular, is interoperability, right?
Correct. Basic interoperability. So the challenge has always been, okay, so where do we draw the line? If we raise the bar too high and make everybody the same, then we have devices that are all the same, no different, other than maybe color of the bezel, maybe, you know, plastics or metal, whatever it might be. But there's not much technology difference because we set the bar too high.
Right.
Also, if you set the bar or don't even create a bar, just say go wild, wild west on this, then you have things that may or may not work. Because one guy only supports 1080p, another guy only supports 720p, so nothing works. So we had to, you know, walk a fine line. So basically what we did was we required all devices that support HDMI to support a bare minimum of interoperable signal. So basically we want you to get a picture. Doesn't mean you're going to get a great picture or guarantee you a great picture, but you're going to get a picture in terms of video and audio. So fundamentally, HDMI bare minimum requirement is 480p and two-channel PCM audio. That's the bare minimum, basically a fallback, you can say.
a serious fallback.
Yeah, yeah. But basically, we're a standard. So we're not here to teach you or tell manufacturers how to succeed. We're going to give you the tools to either succeed or fail, but really that's not up to us. It's up to the technology manufacturers and their ability and their you know, skill set to really either succeed or make really bad products and fail. Really, we're agnostic to that. We just want to ensure that products work as intended. If the intention is to create really crappy $20 DVD players that barely work, that's not for us to judge. That's for the market to judge.
This reminds me of the Blu-ray specification, which I guess is a specification. And it has as its minimum requirement that it must be able to output at least Dolby Digital or DTS, I forget which exactly. They wanted to make sure that you heard something and saw something, not necessarily that you heard and saw 1080p and lossless compression and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
maybe the Blu-ray spec is somewhat similar in this regard.
Many multi, I guess, consortium type spec are like that because many manufacturers want the ability to differentiate. Because if you take that away from them, then what value can a major brand add if you can get the same thing on a Walmart-type brand-type products that are much
sure.
cheaper? So if that's why they want to be able to give manufacturer all the tools necessary. They're not going to take the tools away, but they also don't want to bundle it together where it pretty much makes everything equal. They want
sure.
the manufacturers to have the ability to differentiate and create, you know, $90, $50 Blu-ray players in the future, which would never be possible if everything was forced down their throat.
Sure. Well, this whole thing came up for me, this whole thing about version numbers came up for me when 3D was announced, 3D
yeah.
televisions, 3D
yep.
Blu-ray, and everybody said, and it requires HDMI 1.4. And so at that point, when I first heard about it, I said, okay, it requires HDMI 1.4. Then I heard that the Sony PS3 will be able to be upgraded to 3D, and yet it has HDMI 1.3.
Yep.
So I went, what?
So I
searched you out at CES and asked you the question, and I'll ask you here for our listeners, what's going on with that?
So you got to think of HDMI as a platform. So specification versions, this revise, add new features to the platform. So just because you have a 1.3 device, say you have a set-top box, for example, a satellite box that you bought and that was built on top of the 1.3 specification. So it has certain features that were only available in 1.3. And then 1.4 came out, all this 3D language was defined, and now they're being upgraded. How is that possible? The reason being is specifications define certain features, and the chip itself is just a platform for you to build HDMI features on top of. So if the chip, for example, has the capability to do 3D, has enough bandwidth to do all the necessary, even 4K or whatever it might be that you want to upgrade to, it's really just a upgrade of the chip and the supporting software to support or move that into a 1.4. So you can think of it as akin to, say, upgrading a Windows 3.1, very old operating system. And let's say you have a 486. I'm going, you know, way back, but 486.
Way back. Yeah, you're going way back here. Okay.
16 megabytes of RAM. Well, theoretically, you can upgrade that to run Windows 7, but, I mean, realistically, you can't really use that. And same kind of thing applies to HDMI. So if you have a chip within your, say, set-top box that has the bandwidth or processing power, I guess if you want to put, kind of compare it to a PC-centric model, has enough resources, basically, to handle 3D and whatever else, all it really is a software upgrade, right? Because you're going from a 1.3 software stack, basically, to a 1.4 software stack. Now it's available for people to write to since the specifications release. So those type of scenarios are now possible, but again, it's highly dependent on how set-top boxes are designed. For example, a PS3 was announced very early saying we're going to upgrade to support, you know, 3D. How is that so easily accomplished on a PS3? If you look at the fundamentals of a PS3, it's a computer. It has a processor, memory, graphics card, and a bunch of software on a hard drive. So for them, it's an easy transition. They just upgrade the software like they would do any Windows machines or any Mac machines.
And plus the fact that the processor itself is very powerful.
Exactly, and it's programmable. It's very flexible, which is completely different in terms of architecture of a set-top box or a DVD player or a Blu-ray, because a lot of them have fixed-function chips to reduce cost. So, you know, there's two paths of design, right? You can design a device that's very flexible, programmable, do everything, but it'll cost you arm and leg like the PS3 did when it first came out, $600. Or you can build a, you know, I keep going back to Walmart, but low-cost devices that are fixed function, does one thing and one thing well, yet it's very inflexible in terms of growth. And that's the trade-off a lot of manufacturers have to make in terms of, you know, we want to bring this technology at a lower cost, but that means it cuts off upgrade path, for example, up to a certain point.
So,
and that's the trade-off a lot of manufacturers have to make, and it's unfortunately new paradigm, because it wasn't the case back in the day, you know, when everything was analog. Either, you know, you got something, it just worked for 10, 15 years. You really didn't have to worry about it. But nowadays, everything's moving so quickly. Everything is kind of shifting towards the kind of PC-centric digital world, where everything has a processor, memory, software. So it's not so simple in terms of maintaining and upgrading your components one by one anymore. Not as simple as it used to be anyway.
Yeah. So theoretically, it would be possible to upgrade a Blu-ray player, say, to be able to do 3D, but that depends on whether or not its hardware is flexible enough to do that.
Yeah, and also Blu-ray is a little more complicated, because now you got not only the HDMI chips that you have to worry about, but also the Blu-ray decoders. So the Blu-ray decoders have to understand and know how to decode 3D Blu-ray. And I don't, from my understanding, is none of the current generation know how to do that yet. So those parts have to be also upgraded. And there's no guarantee that every Blu-ray player can be upgraded, because their particular decoder chip may be fixed function. What that means is it's hardwired, so it can't be software upgraded. So in those cases, then you need a 3D-capable Blu-ray player, since yours is not upgradable. So,
well, in the case of a Blu-ray player that's, you know, $150, $200, $250, it probably doesn't matter that much.
Yeah.
Although, of course, there are Blu-ray players out there that are thousands of dollars.
Yep.
Yeah. And people who bought that one, those ones might be a little miffed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, unfortunately, that's the risk you take as a, you know, leading kind of pioneer in the technology, right? And early adopter. Yeah. A lot of times as technology changes, and it's not always for the benefit of the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah. I just got an email, a press release on the release of, speaking of version numbers, 1.4A.
Yes.
What's that about?
So when we first released HDMI 1.4, we also announced that we haven't defined anything for the broadcasters, so in terms of 3D. So we defined 3D in 1.4 for Blu-ray, for movie-type content, and gaming. However, we weren't confident enough in our knowledge of the market to define and mandate a broadcast-specific 3D format. So these formats are compatible for, you know, satellite, cable, over there, whatever it might be, to ensure that they can, we support some sort of a format that's friendly to those type of mediums. The reason there's a difference between, say, a Blu-ray or gaming or locally stored content versus broadcast where it's satellite, cable, or over the air is bandwidth restrictions. So when you look at Blu-ray, it's tons of storage. Look at gaming, they have a lot of local storage, so they don't have to worry about, you know, storage as much. However, if you're broadcasting, you're limited pipe, satellite, cable, over the air. So what we had to do was define what's called 3D structures that enabled squeezing in 3D information. So 3D, you're taking a left eye and a right eye, and you have two basic sets of images. Well, with locally stored, you can just take two full images and just send it to the TV, and then the TV will decode it. However, if you're broadcasting, you need to squeeze that into the existing pipe. What that means is you need to be able to squeeze in 3D onto a, say, a typical 1080i broadcast, or even a 1080p for some satellite, or 720p, whatever the broadcast might be. So there's a technique where you squeeze two images into a single frame. The frame is no different than what you're seeing today in terms of size, but there's compression and other techniques involved that enable you to squeeze in two images to a single frame and broadcast that over existing systems. So existing systems don't see the images any differently. They only see typical frames in 60 hertz or whatever the broadcast might be. And what happens is the TV decodes that properly, takes the top half or bottom half or side. Let me go back a little. There's two types of techniques most commonly used.
Yes, please get into this. This is great.
Yeah. So there's two types. There's what's called top and bottom or over under. So what you're doing is you take, say, a left eye, put it on top of a, say a 1080i image, and the bottom half holds the right eye. So basically, if you looked at this undecoded image, undecoded 3D image formatted into a top and bottom structure, basically you'll see two distorted images on top of each other that look almost exactly alike. But what the TV does is takes that raw image, interprets it, basically reconstitutes the data from the top side, bottom side, creates two full left eye, right eye images, and then transmits that, renders that onto the screen to enable you to get 3D images. So that's one technique. Another technique is another called side-by-side. You can think of it the same methodology where you take two images, but you now squeeze it. Instead of squeezing it top and bottom, you squeeze it side-by-side. So imagine a 1920 by 1080 image, for example. And if you chop that in half horizontally, then you have a certain amount of space on the left, a certain amount of space on the right.
You have 960 by 1080 on
Correct.
The left and 960 by 1080 on the left.
Exactly, right. And you take that image, and you don't really chop the images. What you do is you compress and squeeze the image from the left side, from the right side, and squeeze it into that space I just chopped in half. So you're not really.
So is it sort of like anamorphic squeezing? Is that what?
Yes. You can think of it anamorphic squeezing. It's a similar technique, basically. So you can do that either with side by side or top and bottom, and kind of use similar techniques. You can think of it that way in a simplistic form, and uses compression and uses those type of techniques to squeeze it, so it fits through all the piping, all the satellites, all the cable structure, all the broadcast structure, still couldn't transmit as a normal signal because it's not carrying any more data in terms of raw bandwidth.
And they can't increase the size of that pipe, obviously.
Eventually, but.
But I mean, for now.
For now, yeah. Because, I mean, if you look at it, there's millions of set-top boxes out there. Decoders are already built into the TV, so they don't want to really mess with the existing infrastructure if they don't have to. And this is the technique they use to do that. So what HDMI did was, to support that, has included top, bottom, and side-by-side as mandatory format, or minimum formats, I'm sorry. Minimum format. So what that means is any TV that implements 3D using the 1.4A specification is guaranteed to support the movie formats, the game formats, and the broadcast formats to ensure interoperability. Again, these are minimum, so it's not like you're kind of set in stone in these formats. These are something that they're going to use now, and then in the future they can, you know, up the bandwidth of their pipe and increase quality if they want. There's nothing that stops them. You know, I kind of compare this to our 480p minimum requirement. So our minimum HDMI requirement for interoperability is 480p, two-channel PCM. Many would argue saying, why you set the bar so low, you know, such low quality, no one's going to, you know, do higher quality. Well, you look at it now, you can't find a less than 1080p TV in most cases, in at least the popular sizes. And I think the same thing is going to happen with 3D. Initially, you're going to see, you know, some basic formats that we have defined. But, you know, technology never stands still. So they're going to evolve, and they're going to keep growing and better quality, and they're going to really push the bandwidth. And we're going to look back and say, you know, these requirements were very minimal, but the market moved on and grew without us dictating where they should go.
Right, right. Now, the problem I see with over-under or side-by-side, of course, is that it cuts the resolution either vertically or horizontally in half. So can we really say that that's high def then?
I think so. I mean, because it's more of a compression than, I say, chopping it in half, because basically...
Well, I mean, but you the side-by-side, though, only gives you 960 horizontal resolution for each eye, right?
So you got to think of it as in terms of compression, not chopping it. So if you look at a frame, for example, you cut it in half in terms of space. So now you only have a certain amount of space to fit data into. So think of it.
You're talking about bandwidth there, right?
Correct. So for example, if you're doing internet streaming and you're watching high def, it's high def, but it's a lower quality high def.
True enough.
So it's kind of a similar effect here, because basically...
So each side is getting more compressed, more data compressed?
Correct. You can think of it that way, because what anamorphic kind of distorting of the image does is basically you lose some of the information, kind of like compression, but when you reconstitute, you use kind of algorithms to reconstitute that, almost like compression. So although you don't have the same amount of data as a full-frame 3D, the quality is still pretty good. I mean, just like
I was going to say, it would have to, though, suffer to some degree. I mean,
oh yeah, of course. There's no question that there's with any compression, right, or any kind of technique that reduces bandwidth. But when it comes to, you know, just actual enjoyment, it's not going to be, say, you're watching 1080p and going to 480p. The drastic difference is not that big, I would argue. And a lot of the demos I've seen, it's actually kind of hard to tell, because many a times either the horizontal or vertical resolution is fully maintained. So it's not like you're losing both resolutions. You're only losing one of the two through compression, basically. So there will be differences, but majority of people will not be able to tell the difference. It's kind of similar to, video files. I would be able to notice, say, for example, 1080p, 720p.
Sure.
But majority of the people that I know, at least personally, would not be able to tell very easily between the 1080p and 720p. And I think similar concepts or similar things will happen with, you know, these broadcast format versus full frame Blu-ray formats. There will be people who can notice it. Those people would demand a higher quality. But people who just want to enjoy content would be more than happy with a lot of these half resolution solutions.
Sure. Now, Blu-ray, it does not do any of this resolution cutting or additional or lots of extra compression, as I understand it. It's I attended a webinar not long ago, just last week actually, that they talked about Blu-ray being basically the 2D image, I believe it was the left eye, plus the delta, that is the difference between the left eye and the right eye.
Yeah.
Is that's conforms with what you understand about how the Blu-ray 3D works?
So that's one way. So there's many different techniques. So the full Blu-ray experience would be a full 1080p image for each eye. So there is no kind of math involved. It's actually shot with two cameras, recorded with two cameras into, you know, master, and then from the master it's transferred onto Blu-ray. So that's the goal of Blu-ray in terms of 3D.
And that would require twice the bandwidth that we currently have out of Blu-ray, right?
Correct. So there's the MVC, the multi-visual codec.
Multi-view codec, I
Yeah, multi-view codec is their solution to be able to fit 3D information, full frame, into a Blu-ray and be able to decode that fast enough to get 3D. So they're saying that's going to be the solution, and basically that's how it's going to be done. So what you mentioned, where you take a left image and then create an offset, basically, and a 3D off that. That's a different technique. That's typically what's used to create 3D from a 2D image or 2D movie. So that's one way of doing it, and a lot of technologies look great doing that. So, but the ultimate goal of Blu-ray and the highest quality possible, basically in terms of 3D, would be what's known as frame sequential, or basically full frame 3D. So you're not losing any data. Basically, each eye gets its own dedicated 1080p image every second the image is displayed, and that's the pinnacle of 3D quality today.
But wouldn't that cut the amount of content time on the disc in half?
Not necessarily, because you got to remember a lot of the 3D content that's coming today is in 24 frames.
Yes. Well, that's what most Blu-rays are encoded in anyway, right? Movie
correct.
Blu-rays.
Exactly.
Already
exactly.
In 24 frame. Now that they're going to have to be 24 frame with two images per eye.
Correct.
One image per eye.
Correct. And using MVC and... I'm not a Blu-ray expert, but at least from what I know, MVC will be able to handle that. And since the jump, I mean, it is double the bandwidth, but the compression is efficient enough to supposedly handle all that.
I see.
And that's why it's so important for the Blu-ray player to support MVC and the new decoding capabilities to be able to, you know, decode that properly.
Right. Interesting thing about bandwidth, just as an aside, at one point when I thought 1.3 and 1.4 were different somehow, I looked them up and I realized, hey, wait a minute, they have the same bandwidth.
Yep, exactly.
Maximum bandwidth of 10.2 gigabits?
Correct. 10.2 gigabits is the maximum bandwidth of HDMI. And we really saw no
need. HDMI, hardware-wise, is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. So that's the key difference. Thank you for mentioning that. The specification supports up to 1080p, I'm sorry, up to 10.2 gigabits of total bandwidth.
Right.
Again, that's specification only.
Right, but the 1.2 did not. It only went up to 4 point something, right?
Yeah, 4.9. But remember, that's the maximum. That doesn't mean every single HDMI chip supports that.
Right.
So, you know, like a PC, just because you have a Windows 7 PC that runs at 4 gigahertz doesn't mean every single Windows 7 PC runs at 4 gigahertz.
Yeah, right, of course.
Yeah,
of
so that same kind of analogy applies to HDMI. You might have chips that are built using the 1.4 specification that supports 3D, that may only support, you know, 720p 3D because their chip was designed to only support specific type of bandwidth, and that's what they're limited to.
Right. So why were 1.2 and earlier specs limited to 4.9 gigabits?
At that time, there was no applications beyond what was needed for 4.95. So 4.95 was more than enough to support 1080p with 8 channels of uncompressed audio. Actually, many people don't realize HDMI 1.0, when it was released December of 2002, supported 1080p and 8 channels of uncompressed audio back even before 2003. So, but you really didn't see devices until 3 years ago, maybe, just start rolling out and really didn't get popular until last year, or at least in price enough to get popular. So
Right.
So, you know, what HDMI has always philosophy has been is to kind of be a step ahead of the market. So when we moved to 1.1, 1.2, there was real no application we could think of that really needed more than 4.95 gigabits. Because we knew 1080p was coming, but even if 1080p arrived, it still didn't push the bandwidth limits.
Right.
So what happened was when PS3 was about to be launched, which is about the same year 1.3 was released, PS3 was the first high-def device that were capable of going beyond 4.95 gigabits. So 1080p, 8 channels of uncompressed audio was about 4.5 gigabits. But what PS3 enabled, one of the first devices to enable, was what's called deep color. So deep color was a feature of 1.3 because the market was moving towards billions of colors. So instead of staying at, you know, 8-bit RGB that everybody's used to, what the market was moving towards was 10-bit, 12-bit, billions of colors, a large, wide color gamut, things that were not possible before because of bandwidth. But now HDMI gave them an avenue to be able to push fidelity much further than just resolution. Now in color, but fidelity, color gamut, many other things that were not possible. And that's when we bumped the bandwidth to ensure that future applications that want to go beyond 8-bit, up to 16-bit per color, in trillions of colors, even made a possibility, because of the bandwidth increase.
Well, that certainly seems like a future-proofing idea, particularly since, at the moment anyway, there is no content being created
exactly
with that extra color resolution or the wider color gamut, which we should make sure everybody understands that deep color, as you said, refers to a greater bit depth per color, which means greater, finer gradations of color brightness, whereas the color gamut, which is sometimes called XVYCC,
yes,
or XV color, yep, in the case of Sony, actually expands the range of colors that can be reproduced. But again, in both and HDMI, starting with 1.3, thanks to the 10.2 gigabit bandwidth, can convey those greater amounts of information, and yet there's no content currently being made, and as far as I know, no plans to make, at least at this point, content with that.
At least for the immediate future, there's no Hollywood content. But what we saw was a lot of digital content creators, games, or even kind of online content, and a lot of those professional kind of content creators wanted the capability. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to, you know, come out in large waves, but what you're going to see is slow trickle as the authoring creation, kind of all those devices and capabilities in the back end where they create the content starts catching up. Mm-hmm. You're going to slowly see trickle and device manufacturers take advantage of that. Because right now, basically, the bandwidth and the capabilities are there, but as you said, they're all waiting on content. So as we're going to start seeing slow progression, just like you saw for Blu-ray. And Blu-ray, you know,
right,
1080p type of content took a while, and DVD still dominated and still, I think, does for most part in the worldwide market. And so anytime you have a content transition, there's always going to be a pretty, you know, decent lag time in between that transition.
Yeah, so, true enough.
Yeah, so right now I think where we are at is kind of resolution transition, where you're seeing, mm-hmm, you know, 480p to 1080p. And then I think the next step will be, you know, 3D and a deeper color depth and so on and so forth. I think it will be a transitional period from this point on.
I'm not a gamer, so I don't know. But are there video games that use deep color and expanded color gamut?
I'm not sure. I play a lot of games, but I don't really pay attention to those kind of things.
You're busy avoiding monsters.
Yeah. I'm happy with it. I haven't really paid attention to that, and nobody really makes announcements on those kind of things.
Yeah.
So right now, I'm not sure if there's many, if at all. I think because
certainly there is user generated content. I mean, you can get a Sony HD cam and probably Panasonic maybe, that do record in deep color in XVYCC.
Yes.
And if you play that back,
yes,
on your TV, if your TV has those capabilities to expand, to reproduce the color gamut and the bit depth of the colors, you will see it as intended. But at the moment, that seems to me to be the only source of this type of content.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's the only thing I really see on a regular basis. I mean, there may be games that support it, but again, I'm not sure which games. It's not like a very common thing for them to include. And it's not very difficult for them to do it anyway, because a lot of them work in higher color depth than what they actually produce. So,
true enough.
It won't be
true
hard
enough
for them. But I'm not sure if there's any incentive yet.
Because
deep color itself, by itself, is not a huge, you know, bump in quality. But combined with, you know, XV color, with higher resolution like a 4K going forward, even content that's actually rendered from the get-go in 1080p makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. A lot of the content is, you know, not always sourced at the highest quality possible. So I think once, you know, everything being sourced is at 4K and then, you know, down-res to 1080p, I mean, I think you're going to see really big transitions in terms of quality when everything's combined, not just deep color or XV color by themselves.
Right. We're going to get back to Jeff in just a second here, but before we continue, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com. Audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 60,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For example, one audiobook you might consider downloading is This Is Your Brain on Music by Daniel J. Levitin. I've seen interviews with him, and he's a fascinating guy, a neuroscientist, and a saxophone player. My kind of guy, for sure. Very interesting book, by the way. To download this audiobook, or another one of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. Okay, getting back to Jeff Park with HDMI licensing. I wanted to touch a bit on some issues that I hear a lot of installers talk about, and I hear a lot of consumers talk about as well, and that is cable lengths and speed ratings and various ratings on these HDMI cables. What is the official word on maximum cable length? Let's start there.
So when it comes to cable length, the HDMI specification doesn't limit any cable length. It's really limited by the manufacturer's ability to produce them, because there's different ways of producing cables. You can, you know, create just simple passive cables who are just copper-based, or you can create cables that are, you know, active components in them. So there's many different solutions that are available to make a cable long or short. And really, there's no specification limits. It's really a practical limit on manufacturer's ability to produce them in a cost-effective way.
Certainly, if you have a booster or some sort of repeater in the cable, you can make it almost as long as you want, but then it gets very expensive.
Exactly. So right now, cable manufacturers, I think, are pretty much limited to about 15 meters for a high-speed cable, 20 meters in some cases. But again, that's the norm we've seen. But every year, what happens is cable gets, you know, better, whether it be active components or just better manufacturing. Cables tend to get a little bit longer every year as manufacturers get better. But today, practically speaking, probably about 20 meters for a high-speed cable. If you go to a standard cable, which are just the basic cables that only support 1080i 720p, you can probably go twice that, maybe, in some cases. Again, manufacturer-dependent. But there's, when it comes to cable types or cable categories, there's actually four types right now. With the 1.4. So basically with 1.3, we introduced two cable types. They were standard and high speed. Standard was basically to enable, you know, legacy devices. So anything's up, we're limited to 1080i, 720p. All you needed was these type of cables. Standard cables supported and were tested up to 1080i, 720p. Now, if you want to move up to 1080p or higher, so 1080p or maybe 1080p 3D, 4K, a lot of the new features available in 1.4 and even 1.3, you would need the high-speed cable. The high-speed cable was designed to support the maximum bandwidth of HDMI. What that means is if the cable is tested and certified at the high-speed rating, it supports up to the maximum 10.2 gigabits of bandwidth available in HDMI. So that means it can support everything from deep color all the way to 1080p 3D off of a Blu-ray. There's one wrinkle to this. So there's an introduction to what's known as HDMI Ethernet channel. That's a new feature in 1.4. And that actually requires a different cable that has Ethernet enabled on the cable itself.
Oh, no. Does that mean like one of the other conductors in the cable has become active for that?
Yes. So basically what happened was HDMI has had a reserved pin, basically a pin that was not being used until 1.4. So when you look at the cable from an external consumer point of view, there's no difference. It looks exactly the same, same plug, same, you know, look and feel. Everything's the same. Only difference is the way the cable internally is structured. So now
is it are HDMI cables, even up till now, are all the pins connected in an HDMI cable?
Yes, all the pins are connected, but the difference is since we're running Ethernet over this, there requires some shielding to do what we want it to do. So basically, we are running full duplex 100 megabits Ethernet over an HDMI single wire. So if you kind of look at an Ethernet cable, there's two wires. A typical Ethernet cable has one for send and one for receive. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is sending and receiving sending and receiving at the same time over a single wire, a single pair of wires. In order,
whereas an Ethernet cable has two pairs of wires.
Exactly. But in order to do that, we have to have the cable shielded or the line shielded. That way there's less interference we can deal with.
You mean shielded things. From the other conductors in the cable?
Exactly. So that way we can run high-speed data, 100 megabits, bidirectionally, full duplex, without halving basically the bandwidth.
So, how do you do that? Is it multiplexing?
It's kind of a multiplexing attenuation. Basically, you mess with the signaling. So when it goes positive, you're dealing with basically, I think, send. When it goes negative, you're sending with receive. Mm-hmm. So there's ways of doing that within a single wire, and that's what we're doing over this line. So in order to do that, we have to slightly change the cable construction. Again, the connector is the same. Nothing changes. It's still backward compatible with all existing devices. However, if you have HDMI Ethernet-enabled devices amongst your new gear that's coming out probably later this year, you're going to need these HDMI Ethernet-enabled cables. So how they're labeled will be, you have the standard HDMI cable for 1080i 720p. You have the high-speed, 1080i 720p, and then high-speed HDMI cable, which supports 1080p or higher. And among those two, you have variation with or without Ethernet. So that's the only variation you have among the two cable types. So you have now four possibilities. You can have standard with Ethernet, or high-speed, or high-speed with Ethernet. And those are only four cable types you really have to know in terms of home theater installs.
And hopefully the packages will be well-labeled.
Yes, and we actually, thank you for bringing that up, a perfect segue into... we created logos. So there is going to be, if you go check out hmi.org, we have posted official logos we created that will be used throughout all cables. It's going to be required going forward to be clearly labeled, not only on the packaging itself, thank you for bringing that up, on the package itself, but we also have requirements where the cable itself has to be labeled. So if you look at the actual cable itself, you'll see official wording that has standard cable or high-speed cable or standard cable with Ethernet. It'll be very easily distinguishable from each other when it comes to cables. And I know there are a lot of other, marketing programs that independent companies have come up with different terminologies and whatever
claims
they
have. This is the problem.
Yes. So the key is we're trying to, kind of work with our, lawyers. Dealing with lawyers is not always fun and not always speediest. But we're working with a lawyer, see what we can do on that side. But on the other side, what we're trying to do is unify all other manufacturers under one common name and branding and logo program. So going forward, the key is for manufacturers to ask what official, rating do they have. No matter what else they tell you about their cable, ask them where they stand in terms of official rating. Because, there's two sides to this. If they say, well, ours is better, well, then I would question, whether the manufacturer even knows about the HDMI rules and compliance. I think
this
that's
brings up another question I have for you, which is how much can we, how much can consumers trust the speed ratings, for example, that are printed on the cable box? I mean, is there a standard set of testing procedures that must be undergone?
Yes. So if they claim that their cable is a standard HDMI cable, which is the official, designation, if they claim that, then they have gone through a set of tests and they have met criteria for that particular cable they have constructed. So it has to meet a certain signaling requirements, certain shielding requirements, certain tolerances that are all defined in what's called a compliance test specification. The specification defines what it means to be a standard cable, what it means to be a high-speed cable, what it means to be a high-speed cable with Ethernet. All that's clearly defined. So if they claim something, that means they have passed certain requirements. Having said that, as you know, not all manufacturers are completely honest. So there may be not questionable, functionality, let's just say, when it comes to certain cables. So what we're trying to do, my president always kind of compares this to trying to stop drugs at the border, right? There's only so much you can do in trying to stop some of these non-compliant products from coming into the market. But what we're trying to do is to try to educate the entire market, not just consumers, but everybody, to understand that we really mean business here and that we are going to reward everybody who plays by the rules and really start punishing anybody who really just kind of, you know, pollutes the market with misinformation.
And well, this is great because there's a plenty of misinformation out there, and I want to try and dispel it here with you, talking with you and everything else I do. What, though, can HDMI licensing do? I mean, are you the HDMI police?
Yes, actually, we are. So we own the right to HDMI, the word, HDMI, a high-definition multimedia interface, the spell out of HDMI, the technology. I mean, we have legal rights to the technology itself and a lot of the trademarks. So, for example, if a company claims HDMI in any way, then that's under our jurisdiction. Because even if they use the letter HDMI, that is a trademark of ours. And by using it, they're agreeing to follow by certain rules.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't abide by those rules, then we have legal rights to, you know, take action if necessary. And we have a whole team basically dedicated on, you know, sending those nasty grams that some people sometimes receive. We're very active, and we, you know, work with government kind of, you know, how do I say, border patrol kind of agencies worldwide, and to stop illegal shipments. If there's lost shipments of illegal products, we're going to stop it, and that's something we're looking to expand to not only kind of stop the bad guys, but really help the good guys who are doing this right and going through the processes, actually testing their products to ensure that their customers get the best value out of the equipment they buy, cables they buy, whatever it might be, right?
Sure. Was the next question was, do you actually go out and buy cables from Fry's or Best Buy or whatever and test them yourself just to see how they're doing?
Well, we used to do that a lot more than before, but what we do now is field kind of investigate forums. People complain to us on our website and kind of start from there. Because basically, instead of doing random something, what we saw as more effective was that if people are complaining about something, that means there's something there. Mm. And what we want to do is go after the ones that are kind of more popular. Because what happens with those kind of products is that people tend to buy them more. And since we don't want that to cause any bigger issue than it already has.
Sure.
So we kind of take that approach. We do some random sampling here and there. But for the most part, typically what happens is, you know, a lot of these guys make huge claims or certain claims about their product in terms of HDMI. And then, you know, people start finding out, you know, it was too good to be true kind of, you know, stories, right? And
right.
Those are the ones that we try to kind of go after and make sure it doesn't happen. And also we do a lot of things I can't really talk about publicly, but under the radar that we take care of that you guys never see because it never got to the market. Or, you know, the problem was stopped even before it became a problem. So that's how we kind of take this approach in terms of compliance to ensure not only be kind of active and slap people, you know, when they need to be, but also to ensure that a lot of stuff just never happens. And I think that's kind of how we measure success in terms of compliance activities on the market.
This may be a question you can't really answer, but I'll ask it anyway.
Sure.
Having to do with super expensive cables, you know, some of these companies produce HDMI cables and charge hundreds or thousands of dollars for them.
Yep.
Is there ever a circumstance in which that's really warranted?
Well, you know, it's like buying expensive watches or expensive, you know, phones. I mean, it depends on what you're willing to pay for and what you value, right? I mean,
but in terms of performance, have you ever seen any super expensive cable do better than, you know, a basic or, you know, one that's still certified, one that still follows the rules, but doesn't cost an arm and a leg.
Yeah. So, I mean, if just like anything in HMI world, if it meets the minimum requirements, minimum requirements in the spec, that's all we care about. Anything beyond that is a claim that the manufacturer has to kind of defend and justify. So, you know, we set a bar. For cables especially, we say you have a standard cable, you support up to 720p 1080i. If you have high speed, you support the full 10.2 gigabits of bandwidth. Beyond that is really irrelevant to us because the spec does not go beyond that. the spec only goes up to a certain point. The spec only supports certain features. And beyond that, if they say they use gold and they use this and this, and you know, according to their testing, it's better. Well, you know, better in what way? And that's really not up to us to judge.
Right.
It's a free market. And if they say gold is better, well, if they can justify to consumers saying gold is better because of this, and the consumer agrees with them, right? Agrees with that statement, then it's really a win-win situation from our point of view, really, because it's just a way for people to differentiate. Again, when it comes to actual performance, the spec defines a certain way, and there's only so much, you know, you can do, basically. You know, there's standard and high speed. Beyond that, I mean, it's really not something for us to judge, other than unless they're making false statements, right? They're saying, you know, something that's outrageous. But if it's within the spec and they say certain manufacturing techniques are better, or, you know, they're made by elves who are, you know, making these with fairy dust, I mean, who are we to argue, you know, right? So if people think that's worth it, then they will pay, right? I mean, there's other ridiculous things people have paid tons of money for in the past. So this is, I don't think, anything new in a free market society.
Yeah, true enough, true enough. How do you respond to reports of problems with HDMI connections? I've talked to a number of installers, for example, who say, you know, I've had problems with HDMI. It didn't work right, or had, you know, it didn't connect well, or dropped out or whatever. So I just end up using component.
Yep, yep.
What is your response to those sorts of stories?
So we've had to deal with it for many, many years. So we've gotten to the root of the problem. The root of the problem basically is HDCP software. So HDCP is what the copy protection that's used over an HDMI link. So if you're watching, you know, cable, satellite, Blu-ray, any copy protected content, basically Hollywood content, it's going to have copy protection because we are outputting over HDMI a pristine, almost, you know, reference copies of the actual video because it's uncompressed, 1080p, you know, full resolution, full frame rate, you know, no loss of quality. So Hollywood obviously wants to protect that. So what one of the mandates they had was HDMI outputs must have HDCP, which was a copy protection scheme and software that was developed by Intel and is run by DigitalCP, who is a subsidiary of Intel. I'm sorry. Intel owns DigitalCP, therefore owns HDCP.
Okay. So DigitalCP, I guess, is digital copy protection.
I think so. I don't know what... Yeah, probably. That sounds
probably.
Right.
But yeah, all right.
So this software basically has to do what's called a handshake. So every time it connects, it has to authenticate whatever's downstream, whether it be AVR, TV, whatever it's going to send the content to. It needs to make sure, you know, exchange the keys, make sure the keys are valid, make sure the other device has not been compromised, create a secure link. You can think of it as like, you know, VPN or something between the devices. Basically, no other device can look into that pipe and steal data from it.
Right.
So this has to happen every single time content is sent. There's no way around it. This is the only way Hollywood will allow such high-quality content to be released into a consumer space in uncompressed form, right?
Right.
So in order for you, for the manufacturer to get this done, they had to implement HDCP. So what happened was HDCP was released, and when HDCP was first released back in, I think, you know, 2003 with in conjunction with HDMI, there was no compliance testing. DigitalCP, HDCP really didn't finish compliance tests, the specification that does compliance testing, until 3 years later.
Oh, man.
So that, you know, there was a delay in that, right? So what happened was all the devices that were built prior to that were built to the best of the abilities of the manufacturers, of course. And not like they did it out of malice to screw everybody over. They did what they understood, and everybody kind of understood differently, right? Because
there was
no
compliance testing. There was no consistency.
Yeah, exactly. You might think Section 8 means one thing. I might think Section 8 means a slightly different thing. We plug in our devices together. Whoops. You know, those kind of things happen. And, you know, unfortunately, that's the growing pains of a lot of technology.
Yeah.
And nobody expected HDMI to grow so fast either. And it's not blaming Intel, DigitalCP, or anybody. It's just the expectations were not there to have such explosive growth. So the growth itself was also a catalyst for all the problems because so many devices were being used so quickly, there was not enough time for a lot of these manufacturers to learn and properly understand the new technology of HCCP. Mm-hmm. And HCCP is very software heavy. As you know, anything that requires a lot of software has bugs, and that's just the reality.
So yeah, you're right about that.
So a lot of manufacturers, you know, were learning and kind of understanding HCCP, how to work with it, and compliance tests came out. So if you look at a lot of the newer devices and plug them in, really a lot of them work pretty well, and they're very fast, and majority of stuff work very well together. The problem still exists is older set-top boxes, cable or satellite, or older devices that are legacy devices that the installers are forced to use. So one great example is cable boxes. Many people who live in a certain area, they don't have any other choice. They have one cable provider, and they're kind of stuck with that. That means they're only stuck with one particular model. And that particular model, to complicate things, has different software depending on where you live.
Oh, man.
So if you remember cable back in the day, it might have been in your neighborhood, might have been, you know, Scott's Cable Company.
Right.
2 miles down the road, it might be Jeff's Cable Company. They were all different cable systems, different head-ins, different systems. Everything was completely different. You know, fast forward 20 years, everybody got consolidated under Time Warner, Cox, Comcast, whatever. They may all have the same name, but the underlying system is still completely different. So what that means is I can have the exact same Motorola, Scientific Alana, Cisco set-top box, and you're 2 miles away from me, but we might have completely different software.
Right.
So what that means is just because it worked for one install 2 miles down the road doesn't mean it's going to work exactly the same with the same box in a neighborhood 2 miles away, because they might have a completely different software. And HCCP for that particular region may not have been upgraded to the latest version or whatever it might be.
Right.
So
right.
It really complicates things, and we understand. And what I always tell installers is if you have any issues, just go carry around a high-def 1080p camcorder because it has no HCCP. Camcorders, because they user-generate content, so therefore no need for HCCP.
Oh, that's a good point.
Plug that in and see if your connections work. If it works, then you know for 100% fact it's an HCCP issue. And that way, at least you have a direction to go in terms of how to deal with this. You can contact the service provider. You can contact the manufacturer of this particular source device that you have problems with. Whatever it might be, instead of trying to figure out, is it a connection problem? Is it a software problem? You know, instead of trying to guess, one of the things is to kind of eliminate one of the variables, which would be HCCP, if you can use a, you know, high-def camcorder as your source for all testing.
Right, right. That's a great idea.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, I mean, HCCP is getting better, but installers still have to deal with legacy installed, you know, boxes, especially set-top boxes. And really, unfortunately, that's not going to kind of change quickly, because cable companies in particular are not the fastest moving companies in the world in terms of rollout, as you know.
That's true.
What I always tell installer guys, because we've heard this for many years, and we understand the frustration, especially me, because I've experienced it personally, is to always test your TV source. So if it's satellite, cable, whatever it might be, always test it to make sure you understand the limitations before you go into an install. Because if you understand the problem going in, then you're not going to waste money and time and effort and customer expectations to rip it all out and start over, or, you know, go through all the headaches of troubleshooting. Head that off and kind of understand the limitations. So always set, my always advice is always test your install location's TV service, always, because you never know the satellite cable, if they like their old 2-year-old, you know, satellite box, you might be stuck with that. So you need to kind of, you know, make sure you do your homework before you do any of the TV related installs.
Now, one of the symptoms of an HDMI problem, typically kind of being the cable maybe being too long, is something that I've heard called sparklies.
Yes.
Which are like little, I guess it looks almost like snow on the screen. Is that really due to a cable that might be a little too long for what it's doing?
Yep. So cable typically, I mean, the sparklies are pretty rare actually. But what happens is if you take a cable, HDMI cable, and you send a signal along that cable, if the cable is borderline compliant, so let's say it's supported, it's a standard HDMI cable, so it supports up to 1080i, 720p, say it's 100 feet long, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
If that cable was manufactured and the tolerance it originally manufactured for was, say, within 2% of passing, very, minimal, then what happens is you might have a case where, every time the cable is manufactured, if the manufacturing process is not consistent, that 2% might be gone because, there might be a slight difference in manufacturing every time it gets stamped out.
Sure.
So what happens is if that cable is literally on the borderline of being able to pass or not pass that signal, you start seeing sparklies. What that means is that cable is barely compliant. And and typically the reason that happens is that particular cable is just a defect, basically, within the manufacturing process. And really didn't get processed exact to specification the manufacturer originally designed for. So
if you replace that cable with another cable, it would likely solve the problem.
Yes, likely solve the problem. And if you have the same issue with the same model, then I would question whether that actual design is a proper design for that particular length. So that's something I would definitely go back to manufacturer and and get them to resolve it for you, because if they claim something, it should work, because our tolerance test ensures that if they went through the testing and they have test results to prove it, then it would not have those kind of issues.
Right. What other symptoms might someone see? That's the only one I've really ever heard of.
Yeah, I mean, because it's a digital connection, so there's only really typically two stages. I mean, with the sparklies, there's really three stages now, but typically sparklies are actually more rare than just not working. So typically what happens is either cable works or it doesn't, because it's a digital connection.
You'll see an image or you'll see nothing.
Exactly. Sparklies are actually pretty rare. If you see a sparkly, that means you've actually got a pretty lucky, I guess you can say. You got something. But typically, I mean, with an HDMI cable, either it's going to work or it doesn't. And really, there's no middle ground. I mean, rarely you'll see sparklies, but typically you just not get it working at all.
This is what I was always led to believe, and then this whole sparklies thing came up.
Yeah, yeah. And the sparkly thing really just a defect in manufacturing. It might be just a problem with their manufacturing process. So,
well, let me ask you one other question then before we're almost wrapping up here. But the one other thing I wanted to touch base with you on is what is often called wireless HDMI. We see there are several different companies that are making their own versions of this.
Yes.
Amimon is operating in the 5 gigahertz range. Cybeam is working in the 60 gigahertz range. Some people are using 802.11n. And they're all, interestingly, informally, they're always talking about wireless HDMI, but the names of these technologies never say wireless HDMI.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what does HDMI licensing have to say about all that?
So I would like to clear up one thing. First thing is there's no such thing as wireless HDMI. Reason being is because none of them are created by us. Basically, we are HDMI and we've never released a wireless standard. All these wireless high def transmission technologies don't send uncompressed in HDMI form. So whatever they transmit, they take HDMI in from one end, convert it to whatever proprietary wireless signal they have, typically compression, compress it, send it over wireless, uncompress it, convert it back to HDMI, and then output HDMI. So none of them is carrying the native HDMI signal in an uncompressed form. However, there are solutions that are uncompressed, but just not native HDMI. They're always doing some sort of conversion to send over their native wireless signal. So, Wireless HD, which is run by Cybeam, their technology runs at 60 gigahertz. 60 gigahertz enables them to send uncompressed audio and video. However, they're limited to uncompressed audio and video, typically in a single direction. So they can't send stuff back like we can through Ethernet and other audio return channel of sorts. Also, limitations with the 60 gigahertz, even though it's uncompressed, it's line of sight. What that means is you got to be basically in the same room. If you can't see it, typically you can't send these 60 gigahertz through walls, at least not reliably. And they're really designed for in-room type of distribution. So if you want to go, say, next room or house distribution, you still have to go wired of some sort.
Or use one of the other technology.
Sure. So the other technologies I was going to get to is such as Amamon, which uses 5 gigahertz unlicensed band, is a house distribution. So what they do is they distribute, they can go through walls, they can distribute throughout the entire house. But what they do is basically compression. They may call it something else. They call it, I think, least significant bit encoding. Basically what that means is they drop the least significant bit to maintain fidelity and bandwidth requirements over wireless. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look up the definition of compression, is dropping of information, which is least significant. So I don't know what else to call it but to call it compression. But regardless of what they call it, they're trying to fit uncompressed content into a 5 gigahertz stream and over, you know, maybe 300 megabits per second or something like that, which is not possible unless you use compression. So a lot of these other lower gigahertz, lower bandwidth wireless technologies can deliver wireless high def quality in good quality. I mean, it's not like they're terrible quality, but again, they're not the full uncompressed HDMI type quality that HDMI wires can deliver. They can deliver great quality, but it's not wireless HDMI. They're using other technologies that are unrelated to HDMI.
An intermediary technology, which always makes me a little suspicious.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you know, we're trying to kind of clean that up too, because they're trying to ride the coattails of HDMI, because everybody knows HDMI. So if they attach wireless to it, then all of a sudden they become legitimate. So that's one thing we're trying to kind of clean up, because it's, I think, unfair usage of our trademark, because they just label it wireless HDMI, then all of a sudden they get the notoriety that we have built up. So,
well, actually, most of them, in fact, are not using that term, at least not formally.
Yes, yes.
For the reason I'm sure that that you have specified.
Yes, yes.
Is HDMI licensing working at all on a wireless specification?
No, not right now, because there is no really reliable, cost-effective technology today. That's available today. And
so you've looked at all of them and you've said none of them are what I want to
use. So the seven founding companies are constantly looking at new technology and looking to improve HDMI. But right now, wireless itself, because another big hurdle a lot of the C manufacturers see is really power. Until that problem is solved, wireless really does not add that tremendous benefit, a tremendous amount of, I guess, cable freedom until the power line can disappear somehow. So
I see what you're saying.
Yes,
in other words, each device still has to be plugged in.
Exactly. So you can hang whatever you want on the wall, but you got to still deal with the power line, the power cable.
Right. So until, if you're going to deal with a power cable, you might as well deal with an HDMI cable.
Exactly. So if you're going to route your power cable, it's not that difficult to route one more cable. And typically that's what's happening today. Wireless is nice for many solutions. I'm not saying wireless is, you know, something that's not useful. I mean, I think it's great. I think many applications, wireless is more than enough. But for a reliable, consistent, high-quality connection, I don't think you can be wireless. Whether it be HDMI, whether it be Ethernet, it doesn't really matter. Wire is not going to go away because of the reliability that it brings today.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at, for example, any internet server room, no one uses wireless, even though it's been a pretty mature technology for a long time, because wireless by nature is just a very difficult technology to keep consistent on an ongoing basis. So,
Right. Let me return quickly to HDMI 1.4, I believe, which includes another feature that I wanted you to address just briefly, and I should have mentioned this earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't. You mentioned 4K.
Yep.
Obviously 3D. Ethernet over internet, and then there's one called audio return channel.
Yes,
and I'd like you to explain what that is.
So audio return channel is just really, again, cable simplification. It's nothing revolutionary, but it's basically something that enables ease of setup. So today, if you have a high def TV, for example, and you're getting over the air content, or maybe has a cable car tuner built in, so you're getting content from directly built into the TV, whether it be Netflix streaming, Vudu streaming, you know, Blockbuster, whatever it might be, YouTube. Let's just say it has capability of you know, getting surround sound content directly inside the TV, whether it be tuner, you know, or internet.
Right.
Today, if you want to get surround sound from that particular TV, you'd have to run a typically an optical cable, a SPDIF cable, back to the AVR, a separate cable so you can get surround sound processing instead of using your built-in speakers to your TV.
Right.
Well, that requires a separate cable, even right. though you have an HDMI connection already going from your AVR to your TV. What audio return channel enables you to do is now eliminate that bit of cable and just use the existing HDMI connection that's with devices that support audio return channel, of course, to enable you to send audio back using that same HDMI connection.
So I
see. Yeah, instead of running a separate cable, now that same SPDIF connection is now available within the HDMI connection, returning back to the AVR.
So once again, it's a cable simplification.
Yep, exactly. Feature. And it has the same functionality as SPDIF, basically. You know, Dolby Digital, DTS, two-channel PCM.
Two-channel?
Yes. So it can't do, you know, high def, basically. So it supports...
Can it do multi-channel, 5.1?
Yeah, yeah. So Dolby Digital, DTS, and two-channel PCM. So anything that fits inside the two-channel PCM, basically like Adobe Digital or DTS.
Okay, so Adobe Digital can be 5.1.
Oh, yeah, of course. But those are basically compressed surround sound formats.
Lossy compression.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. So they can fit inside basically about the bandwidth of a two-channel PCM. So.
I gotcha. Okay, yep. All right. Great. Well, that pretty much uses up all of our time. I want to thank you, Jeff Park, for joining me today. A very informative conversation.
Well, thank you. They were great questions. I'm happy to answer them in the future time also. So thank you for this time.
Great, great. Be sure to check out HDMI Licensing's website at hdmi.org. And also, please visit me at my online homes at ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Gene Dolgoff, the inventor of LCD projection and currently working on 3D. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I hope you'll join me then. Until then, geek out!